All right, let me invite everyone to join me up here. Thank you so much, Brian. A couple of questions, and I've kind of been waiting to ask these questions because they've come in earlier, but you've finally gotten to this topic. You started with that story of you and Davis selling your house and moving. Maybe everybody kind of understands that because you're the pastor of the church, so you need to be close. How much should proximity be affecting church members as they think about picking a church, joining a church, how they manage their own lives here?
You know, I mean, I'm cautious when I answer because I understand the Northwest context, and I've watched members where they're, you know, 15 minutes in this direction, 15 minutes in that direction, 30 minutes, job change, things like that. When I came back from my internship in D.C., I was not a pastor, and my wife and I were looking for a place, and we did endeavor to find a place in as close a proximity as we could to the church body that we were gathering with, that it was at least a consideration in our mind. You know, I hesitate to just tell people, always move, because I've had members that, you know what, they are choosing to commute, and they are proving themselves to be invested despite that commute.
Sure.
I've also seen people who live very close and are not committed, you know.
Yes.
So proximity isn't everything, but it's not nothing.
Yeah.
Right? And there is an extent where we can shoot ourselves in the foot by not considering how the choices we make might impact our ability to invest in relationship with other members of the church.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
So now let me jump to the end of your talk, because you were talking about just the unity of the church. How much do we have to be unified on in order to experience that unity that you're talking about? We've talked about being united around a statement of faith, a church covenant. Like, do we have to be united on other things too? You could think of politics. You could think about homeschool versus government school. Various sorts of divisions. How do we, should we be actively trying to cultivate unity in those things in order to have a unified church?
The kind of bells you ring the most often are going to kind of be what people begin huddling around. And for me, the matters of first importance, if that doesn't show up as our emphasis, I think we could find ourselves trying to build lesser unity rather than greater unity, right? Unity in lesser things. And when we have unity in the greater things, namely Christ, the gospel, well then, lesser matters that we might not be unified on, we're able to love one another and bear with one another because our unity is built on something that is even more firm than that.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think the bell that we ring, the emphasis that we make, is going to find its way into the center of what is unifying us. And there's a lot of things that Christians can be united in other than Christ.
Yeah.
And other than the gospel. And so that's something I've sought in my teaching to guard against and try and find people who are on the outskirts of popular voices and opinions within our body and give them a voice and show that they are worthy of respect and love. Now, obviously, there are lines that need to be drawn in certain cases, right? In as often as we can, recognizing that the differences that exist in the body often is used by God to refine the body and to challenge our charity, challenge our love, so that it might give expression in ways that are genuine.
That's good. Kyle?
Well, I was just going to say this is one of the ways that the glory of the church can shine is when we don't have unanimity we remain united in the gospel. So mm-hmm. we could look at this, certainly in the body, we've experienced this maybe at an elder level, something like that, where we can defer to one another, we can actually have disagreement. And that's something that is distinct from the world, I think, especially right now, mm-hmm. that if we disagree, we're at enmity in a sense, and what we're saying is we are finally united in Christ, and so we can walk together in unity.
Okay, just now for any of you guys, Brian painted this picture of people invested, right? Identified and invested. How do you cultivate that?
Did you notice how holy he sounded talking about the church budget?
Oh, yeah.
I was just like, church budget, ugh. He's like, we get to invest.
It was excellent.
I'm like, you are a better Christian than me.
But we already knew that. Yeah, okay. All right. Practically, how do we cultivate this kind of culture of membership? How long should we expect it to take? What are some of the things that we could be doing to encourage it?
It takes a really long time. If you're talking about this entire vision that we're presenting here this weekend, Brian and I were talking on the way and on the way to lunch earlier, and I said, gosh, it was like 7 or so years ago that the Lord kind of brought me and our elders to these convictions. And I would say it's only recently where I feel like, okay, we're doing what we ought to be doing. And so that's a lot of teaching. It's a lot of conversations. It's a lot of answering over weeks and months and years, the type of questions, 100 or more that are coming on your iPad.
Yeah.
That's just living those questions out, answering them. But it does take time. And I think we have to go into our churches. That's one of the things that you all can leave here with. You have to go in with a measure of great patience. Even 2 Timothy 4 talks about great patience in our teaching. And that's what we have to walk with our brothers and sisters in Christ.
That's good. Other thoughts there?
The one thing I would just add is, sometimes when we get this vision of where we desire the church to be and where it's at, we think we can't enjoy the church until we get there. But there's something about enjoying being in the process together, that rather than despising my brothers and sisters because they're slowing down the process, recognizing that getting there together is better than getting there by myself.
Sure.
And so enjoying the process. I love watching light bulbs go off in people's minds. It's like, they weren't getting it for like 3 years, but there was stuff they were getting, and now they get that too. Yeah. And that's just a joy to watch unfold, and you get reminded, even as you're trying to lead, I'm not in control.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think one kind of category of pastoral leadership that can be a help for what both Brian and Kyle are talking about is any way you can foster an awareness of the whole, so members being aware of the church as a whole, in sermon application, doing corporate application to what does this mean for the life of the whole church? When I've been teaching Wednesday night Bible study in our church for years, I'll often have questions about how does this impact the life of our whole congregation or what we do together as a church. I think, having a prayer meeting, that is a priority for the whole church to attend, whether it's a Sunday evening service or a midweek meeting, but it's a whole congregational meeting. And to have a pastor leading in, here are matters to prayer for our whole congregation. That we'd foster a culture of members discipling teenagers, or that we'd be bold evangelists and see conversions, or that we would be generous in sending and supporting missionaries. Those are things to help members invest affectionately, invest their care, their effort in what the whole church is doing. And it's implicitly catechizing all those members to think, well, what could I contribute to this? How could I help? What might I be able to do to disciple a teen or send or support a missionary? So you as a pastor can kind of feed out those concerns and help them take root in the heart of individual members for what's going on in the church as a whole.
At the same time, I don't think I need to tell you this. You all experience this, but kind of set our expectations rightly. I'm in a healthy church where we share, me and the elders and the congregation share a similar view of philosophy of ministry, and that there's a lot of unity, but we still disagree on stuff, and it still gets frustrating. And the elders were recently disagreeing on stuff, and I was getting annoyed, and I was like, these guys, And I was kind of getting self-pitying about it. And like, part of me was like, I want to go somewhere else.
That comment earlier about better Christian.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah.
Amen. I know he doesn't feel that way, right?
Sometimes keep it's going. Like, keep Lord, going. Help me keep going.
Yeah, well, but you know, then I was encouraged, ironically, by where me and another guy are preaching through 2 Timothy right now. And you get to the end of 2 Timothy, and those final verses, and Paul's like, yeah, and Demas abandoned me, and Alexander the coppersmith opposed my message. This is the Apostle Paul.
Yeah.
Like the end of his ministry. And that stuff is still going on? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, I guess that's the Christian life. I guess that's the ministry. People are going to oppose you and disagree with you all the way.
Yeah.
And even as we talk about healthy church and we talk about unity, there's going to continue to be those thorns in the flesh, disagreements, people opposing us, and yet we learn to forbear through that. That's where we get to exercise the fruit of the Spirit in ways we don't want to, right?
I want to say one last thing on this. In a sense, even when you get there, how long does it take to get there? You're never there.
You're never there.
So our churches are constantly turning over. So that means I've got to start over teaching about membership, showing them the glory of what the body is meant to be, and then they'll learn it, and then they'll leave, and new people will come. This is essentially just taking us back to, Brian, to Ephesians 4, where pastor teachers are to equip the saints for the work of ministry. That pastoral work never ends. And so don't get frustrated along the way. Just know that this is what the Lord has called you to.
I once heard somebody say, and please don't take offense at this, and I didn't say it, but I appreciated it, to be a pastor is to be a perpetual kindergarten teacher. You teach things, and you teach fundamentals and basics, and then they leave, and you get to do it again with a new group of people. And that's just the life of a church. Okay, let me push the discussion in a slightly different direction. You're painting this picture of members encouraging members, building one another up, deeply invested in the life of the church. Can you speak specifically to what this means for single members, and particularly single women in the life of the church, who often feel like, well, I can't teach, I can't lead that Bible study. They feel a lot of can'ts in their life. Well, what does it look like for them to be a part of this mutual building up together? That's to anybody.
I think some of the things you just mentioned, they shouldn't feel can'ts. Okay. I mean, I think we need to view our brothers and sisters, all of them, first as members. Mm. They might be married members, they might be parents, but they're first Christians. And so to view them that way and believe, like the scriptures would have us believe in 1 Corinthians 12, that they have a gift that I need and my gifts are meant for their good. And so that immediately breaks down these walls and we can walk together in growth.
I do think, you know, our church is just over half single of those, or just under half single, and just over those, or just over half of those, it's a quarter single women is what I'm trying to say. Sorry, our church is a quarter single women.
Yeah. That's hard.
Simpler way. I'm a words guy, not a math guy. That's a simpler way to put it. And I think some of those sisters, there is a frustration with desires for marriage and children, and wondering if the Lord's going to provide that. There could be a sense of frustration of being in a city where they kind of have to hack it on their own and make it on their own, and that's kind of not what they are desiring or feel like they signed up for. And I do think one of the ways we can help to care for and provide for those sisters is to be mindful of ways to fold them into families, to have kind of like regular standing relationships, kind of bringing people into the lives of different households. And so I do think it's not that you have to be part of a family to be part of the church, by no means, but that by becoming part of the church, you sort of gain access to all these different families that in some ways can become a family to you that you didn't have before that you wouldn't have otherwise. So it is something we want to, you know, we talk in our church about folding singles into the lives of families. And not just women, but single men too. How are single men going to learn to be godly husbands and fathers? But by seeing it modeled, and especially guys who didn't grow up with that. So I think on the other hand, a whole bunch of our single women are amazing at hosting, hospitality, discipling relationships, serving as deaconesses, mentoring youth. I mean, I can think of a number of single women who mentor my own daughter who's in youth group as a 14-year-old. Mentoring youth, leading Bible studies. We've sent out single sisters as missionaries, women teaching a women's Bible study. We have, I mean, on and on, the kind of ministry initiative that some of these single sisters take is amazing. So they're a great asset to the ministry of our church. And we want to sort of encourage them to use all those gifts to build up the body.
Good. Something that struck me when we planted Cheverly Baptist is we planted with basically 30 and 40 somethings with little kids. We don't have singles, a few. And reflecting back on Capitol Hill Baptist, which you said is almost half, it became clear to me over time what a dramatic powerhouse of ministry all the singles are at your church that my church feels to some extent the dearth of, because we're all like dealing with our kids, right? Which is to say, brother pastors, if you have singles, you should be looking for ways to leverage them for lots of good ministry, male or female, in your church. And losing them helped me realize that. With women in particular, to borrow a phrase, you know, you think about Romans 16 and so many other passages, to borrow a phrase, pastor, are you doing a good job of communicating that women are essential and indispensable to fulfilling the Great Commission? Because Paul seems to behave that way with who he's partnering with and who he's committing and so forth. So whatever you're doing programmatically in your church, is it clear that the married and single ladies are an essential and indispensable part of the Great Commission work of your church?
That's good. That's good. And with that, I think we're going to call it and give you guys a full 15-minute break, because we've been at this for a long time. We've got one more address to come and then a longer Q&A. I know there are tons of your questions that I haven't gotten to yet, but we will have extra time at the end and I'll try to get through more of them. So we're going to take a break. We'll be back at the top of the hour.